Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start off today with some interesting science news. Coming soon to a TV screen or a magazine near you, new blockbuster cholesterol drug reduces LDL cholesterol by over 50%. Exclamation points, happy, smiling people holding hands. Yeah, it's all going to be happening. So let's take a look at this new concept, which are actually monoclonal antibodies against the LDL receptor. Now, they show a lot of promise in certain groups, people with super high cholesterol, for example, who can't be adequately managed by statins, and we'll get into some of the mechanisms of that in just a few minutes. These new drugs, catchily named Repatha and Praluent, are part of a new class of agents called PCSK9 inhibitors. And so far as I can tell, they don't have anything to do with dogs. But they are a unique approach to lowering cholesterol. Whether they can actually deliver on the promises that are already being made in the advertisements is another matter. So I thought it was important that we spend a little time today examining both the mechanism of action of these drugs and the evidence that they will actually do what the advertisements say. Let's start out with a liver cell. A decrease in cholesterol inside the liver cell triggers the production of the LDL receptor. These are then transported to the surface of the liver cell. Along comes a molecule of LDL, and it attaches to this LDL receptor, which then spins off the cell membrane and carries the LDL back into the cell, drops it off where it needs to be, and then returns to the cell surface. The LDL receptor recycles itself up to 50 times before the receptor itself is taken to the recycler. Sounds straightforward enough, but that's anything but how biological systems tend to work. Here's the rub. Every time the cell makes LDL receptors, it also has the DNA turned on to make these PCSK9 molecules. PCSK9 is carried to the cell surface and released into the bloodstream. Now, the PCSK9 can bounce around in the bloodstream and actually attach to the LDL receptor. And it acts as a sort of flag. The next time that particular flagged LDL receptor takes up an LDL molecule and moves it into the cell, both the receptor and the LDL and the PCSK9 are sent straight to the recycler, thus reducing the number of LDL receptors on the surface of the cell. The drugs in question are monoclonal antibodies to PCSK9. They attach to it and cause it to be degraded in the bloodstream by other mechanisms so that it's not able to label those LDL receptors for recycling. More LDL receptors on the surface of the liver cells, less LDL circulating in the bloodstream. So what happens when you introduce a statin drug into this process? Well, in some people, you end up chasing your own tail. Think about it. The statin lowers the amount of LDL cholesterol. This leads to an increase in LDL receptors in the hepatic cell because it's trying to grab LDL. But it also leads to an increase in PCSK9, which causes those LDL receptors to be almost immediately removed from the cell surface. And as a result, you're chasing your own tail. And you fail to keep the LDL low enough to achieve the treatment goals. Now, on the good side, monoclonal antibodies are very, very specific. And these don't have another target besides PCSK9. One of the things I worry about is whether or not PCSK9 could have some other use that we haven't identified. Some other property, perhaps, that's important in another physiologic process. And we may not find out about that for a long time, because first we have to eliminate it from people's bodies, and then we have to see what happens to them over the long haul. That's true of any new agent, and I don't think that's a reason to reject it out of hand. But it needs to be looked at appropriately and proportionately. And unfortunately, that's something our medical system does not do very well. Let's examine the data in favor of the use of PCSK9 inhibitors in combination with statins in individuals with very, very high cholesterol levels. Sometimes people have LDL levels of up to 500 due to mutations, and these run in families. And such individuals, if they have two bad genes, have very early heart disease, sometimes developing signs of atherosclerosis as early as their teens. And that's really who this drug was designed for. But that doesn't mean it's who it's going to get used in. There are two FDA-approved drugs, evolocumab, which is Repatha, and alirocumab, which is Praluent. And there's another one coming down the pike in stage 3 studies as we speak. The evidence in favor of these drugs that led to their being approved was a large study enrolling over more than 23,000 people worldwide. It combined several studies. And effectively, what you need to know is that the individuals had high cardiovascular risk with elevated LDL despite maximum doses of statin therapy. Most of the individuals in these studies had already had one coronary artery event or a similar event, such as a stroke. Over the course of a year or so, the groups diverged. Those on usual high-dose statin therapy and those taking statin therapy plus one of the PCSK9 inhibitors had a difference in their LDL cholesterol that was really quite astonishing, a 61% reduction, more than half as much, and that's very, very substantial. Over the course of a couple of years, the group that was using the PCSK9 inhibitors plus a statin diverged significantly from the group using the statin alone. They had a 61% reduction of LDL-C levels and a 53% reduction in multiple cardiovascular events, a composite of those strokes, TIAs, chest pain, or need for revascularization that are usually used in studies of this kind. Adverse effects were about the same. There were perhaps more neurocognitive events, that is to say, statin brain, and maybe a little bit more muscle-related events. But the frequency was rare enough that it could have been due to just random chance, and it didn't reach statistical significance. But what we don't know, and what it is so important to understand, is that we don't know if this will actually have an effect in moderate risk patients or the average guy with an LDL cholesterol of 170 or so and no other risk factors. And yet, it's my concern that that's the very population that these drugs will be used for. I'm particularly concerned about these being misused in patients who are statin intolerant, that is to say, people who get muscle pain or brain fog, or for whatever reason are not able to take a statin. There is no evidence, absolutely none whatsoever, that this drug does anything more than block a side effect of statin administration, which is to say, increased PCSK9 inhibitor levels. That is, PCSK9 levels, which are being generated by the statin itself. There's actually a lot of evidence that LDL cholesterol is not the problem in most people, that individuals with non-pathologic levels of LDL are actually at risk because of inflammation of the LDL that they possess. And statins, being an anti-inflammatory class of drugs, have been very successful at reducing event rates in high-risk individuals. The question I have is, what about other cholesterol-lowering agents? Is there any evidence that they also reduce events? And when you look at drugs like Zetia or gemfibrozil used in isolation without a statin, you find no difference in events. Sure, they lower the cholesterol, but they don't stop the heart attacks. So what are we doing with this? What will we do with this? And will it be used appropriately? And those are very big questions in my mind. I guess we'll stay tuned, but just in case your doctor offers you this as an alternative, don't expect it to work. We don't have any evidence that it will on its own. When you think about the brain, you probably think that it contains mostly nerve cells. Well, if you think that, you'd be wrong. Actually, by volume, immune cells are more than half of the volume of cells in the brain. And in terms of individual cells, it's about 70%. Now, these immune cells are called glial cells. And the most common glial cell is the astrocyte. In its unactivated state, the astrocyte is kind of the neural nanny. It serves as a precursor for energy molecules. It provides molecules like amino acids that serve as the precursors to transmitters. It sort of spoon-feeds the nerve cell everything it needs. Plus, it's laid out in a grid that provides structural support. So your nanny rocks your neurons to sleep and gives them their bottle and keeps them happy and content so they can perk along and form thoughts. Well, that's great until something happens like inflammation that activates the nanny. And at that point, nanny starts to spank. And unfortunately, these glial cells begin to release lots of chemical signals that inflame the brain and interfere with a lot of processes. What research is now showing is that what we call chronic pain, central sensitization, neuroplastic changes, altered pain modulation, fibromyalgia, what these are really are signs of an inflamed brain where these chemicals are being released, and they perpetuate the pain and amplify it, actually changing the way the brain perceives pain and making it worse. This is particularly seen in cases of pelvic pain and visceral pain. So think about irritable bowel syndrome and things like that. So those types of very difficult to treat medically pains are, in fact, difficult to treat because inflammation of a different sort, a central sort, is driving it. And we have very, very few drugs to deal with this kind of inflammation. These principles have been fully validated in rats, knockout mice, things where you can really get in there and show what's going on physiologically. But we believe that the same thing is true of humans, and there's ample evidence that it is. What I found most interesting about this glial hypothesis of pain is that many of the things that I've been using in my practice for close to a decade actually have pretty strong scientific legs in working with this type of a model of what's going on. I'm talking, for example, about stuff I pick up at functional medicine conference. Now, I've been going to the functional medicine conferences for years, and what I love is I bring back things that change my practice and really fundamentally help my patients, stuff I didn't see in medical school, and I still don't see in medical school. More's the pity. Although I will put a shout out to a Dr. Shah in Stanford, Neha Shah, rheumatologist, who gave one of my patients a really, really fine package of functional medicine advice for things that he should be doing in his body. And I was impressed. So respect out there to Neha Shah in California. Now, back to the wonderful things that I've brought home over the years around pain. First one is low-dose naltrexone. Now, it turns out that among the things that inflame glial cells, opiates, including your endogenous opiates, but particularly external opiates, like the ones that stimulate the opiate receptors, like, say, Vicodin, for example, well, they're pro-inflammatory, so they'll tend to perpetuate the chronicity of pain. How about that? People who have been in chronic pain respond well to low-dose opiate antagonists. And we're talking about doses that are literally a tenth of what you would use to treat an overdose of opiates. And these can be given orally. Naltrexone, 4 to 5 milligrams orally, can make a big difference in chronic pain. And there's not only a mechanism, there's also data that support that. Another thing that helps these glial cells be less inflamed, omega-3 fatty acids. And anyone who's been a regular listener knows that I am way on top of the hobby horse, that we don't get enough omega-3 fatty acids, that we need to flip that omega-3, omega-6 ratio, that we can make ourselves feel better if we just take some fish oil. And the data also support that this has a strong modulating effect on the inflammation of glial cells. There's also research that supports the idea that the use of omega-3 fatty acids may actually reduce the severity and prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. And that is another inflammatory process we've all become to recognize. Glial cells also express cannabinoid receptors. And there's evidence emerging that stimulating these cannabinoid receptors has a profound anti-inflammatory effect and is also neuroprotective. So I look forward to seeing what emerges, but I think CBD is one hot property when we talk about natural medicine, and particularly medicines that can get into the brain and have a positive effect on these slippery, stealthy, and manifestly dangerous autoimmune inflammatory cells that we need, but we need to keep them calm so that we don't get the spanking nanny. It's time to pivot to answering some emails. But before I do that, I have an announcement. Starting the first weekend of July, I'll be back on the air for an hour every month, and hopefully we'll build from there. And I'll be including the questions and answers from that hour in the podcast, not as a complete show, but peppering the podcast with those Q&As to reproduce the feed that we've had for so many successful years. If you're in the Monterey Bay area and can tune in to KSCO, that's 1080 on the AM dial, then please join us at 3 p.m. on Saturdays, the first Saturday of every month. Now it's time for some emails. Jane in Capitola writes, preemptive hysterectomy follow-up question. Dear Dr. Don, thank you for your response to my question on preemptive hysterectomy. I now have a couple of follow-up questions. It turns out my biopsy showed atypical hyperplasia, which my doctor says has a 40% chance of developing into cancer. Does your recommendation still hold in this case? And if so, do I need a prescription for progesterone cream, or will the over-the-counter products be adequate? Jane, once we move into the area of atypical hyperplasia, the chances of developing cancer, if nothing is done, is about 40%. Depending on your physician and your willingness to undergo the D&C that I talked about, it would be possible for you to attempt to clean out the uterine lining and then use progesterone on a regular daily basis. But I don't think you could use over-the-counter progesterone. And I personally would use oral natural progesterone rather than a cream, because then you can be more clear on the dose and the absorption. Should you decide to undergo this experiment in order to keep your uterus, you would need to have regular ultrasounds and probably another D&C after about a year of using the progesterone, even if the ultrasounds looked fine, just to be sure that there was no more atypia left. It may sound like a lot of effort to keep a uterus, but that is your decision. The biggest difficulty you'll have is getting your physician on board with monitoring this, as this is definitely stepping a little bit outside of the comfort zone for the doctor. It doesn't hurt to ask, but please don't do anything unless you have a physician on board supervising you, doing the ultrasounds, and prescribing that progesterone. I would probably use a higher dose, perhaps 200 milligrams of natural progesterone. There's also a pharmaceutical called Prometrium, which, oh my God, is natural progesterone. They just went ahead and managed to get FDA approval for it. So go them, and maybe your insurance will even cover it. But remember, you need supervision and regular ultrasounds to monitor the situation. Do I think you could turn it around? Yes, I do. But there's no guarantee, and one has to hedge one's bets. Diana in Monterey writes, "Dear Dr. Don, I loved your most recent podcast that included the personal history with GERD and the course you took to resolving the esophagitis gastritis. It was very helpful to follow the steps, symptoms, Prilosec, endoscopy, traditional med pathway, and then the pivot to functional medicine, the IgG panel, with the chicken being the culprit. My experience with the traditional route would probably culminate in Prilosec to treat the symptoms without any resolution of the cause, food sensitivity. So it was wonderful to hear how you incorporated the best of both worlds to heal the GI tract. Just wondering, would you consider offering a case study on your podcast where you walk the audience through another medical dilemma that includes the combo of traditional and functional approaches to treatment? We'd learn how valuable the functional methods are in the right hands much more quickly. Hope you continue to have a successful avenue to educate us active listeners." Well, thank you, Diana. That's an excellent idea, and I see every reason that I'm going to follow your advice. Let me take this moment to solicit my podcast listeners. If you have suggestions for format shifts or changes or ways that I can improve the program, please let me know. I can't promise I'll follow all of them, but I certainly want to hear them. This from Rebecca in North Carolina. Subject: urticaria and angioedema. I'm a 60-year-old healthy woman recently diagnosed with hives. Daily treatment is 1 Allegra, 2 Zyrtec, and 1 Singulair, and currently this lessens the symptoms, but I feel like I'm mummifying. I'm told by my doctor a lifetime antihistamine regimen will be required. I'd prefer a cure. Can you suggest an alternative treatment plan? Well, Rebecca, let me start by saying that you're on too many antihistamines, and it makes me extremely nervous that you may be putting your central nervous system at risk over the long term. And no, I don't agree you need this. There have been lots of studies suggesting that long-term antihistamine use could potentially increase the risk of dementia. And in light of that, I've gotten, well, let's just say that I approach it differently. Let's start with the regimen that you're currently on. The medical regimen that I use to handle hives and angioedema is an antihistamine, one of the three drugs you're taking, probably the Zyrtec would be good, and an H2 blocker like Tagamet or Zantac. You see, the skin has both H1 and H2 receptors, and your doctor doesn't have you on anything to block the H2 receptors. The Singulair is a leukotriene inhibitor, and while it's useful in allergies for a different reason, I'm not aware of any studies that show that it has that much value for skin symptoms. So I'll take the fifth, as they say, on the Singulair, but I think you should probably just be on one Zyrtec and a reasonable dose of Tagamet or ranitidine, Zantac, and see how that works for you. That'll reduce your antihistamine risk. Now, that may control your symptoms, but it doesn't get to the root of the matter. There's something going into your mouth. Now, it could be that you're inhaling a lot of pollen or mold spores, and then they're getting into your nasal mucus, and that's dripping down into your throat like it's supposed to, and you're swallowing it, and it's getting into your intestines that way. But you are being exposed to something that's triggering the immune response. So, functional medicine response to this. Step one, probiotics. Relatively high doses, at least 10 billion, and I'd probably give you 20, of Lactobacillus rhamnosus. This is sometimes also called Lactobacillus GG. This agent sends a stop signal to the allergic immune system that's mediated by the mast cells in your skin that are releasing this histamine. The second agent I would add is quercetin. Quercetin is a bioflavonoid. It's found in apple skins, and maybe it's the origin of the old "an apple a day keeps the doctor away." But regardless of that, quercetin is an excellent agent to modulate the immune system, particularly the mast cells. It quiets down the mast cells, and that's what we really need you to be doing. A third thing to think about is the gut. And where I would go with you not knowing your case particularly well would be to say, go to my website and download the elimination diet. You'll find it in the resources page. Follow that diet for about a month, and assuming that you've got good symptom control on your hives and angioedema with the regimen I've already described, then stop those agents, stay on the diet, and see how you do. If the symptoms come back, then the elimination diet hasn't eliminated the thing that's driving it. The elimination diet hits the usual suspects, but as we know, it's not always the usual suspects who commit the crime. That would be step one. So go ahead and follow through with what I've advised. If you're still having problems and the usual suspect approach doesn't work, then let me know and we'll pick up with part two of this. One caution, don't just start eating everything willy-nilly when you stop that elimination diet, whether it has worked or not. Go back on the foods one at a time and be sure that you are taking something for symptom coverage, because it all could come rushing back if you just decide to go out for beer and pizza and have some shrimp and, some peanuts and, maybe a glass of soy milk. I mean, if you take all of those things all at once, we'll never figure it out. So the elimination diet does need to be done with commitment, and you don't just start everything all over again once you've done it. Let's see if we can get on top of your symptoms first, and then come back for more advice. Janet in Schenectady writes, "Dear Dr. Don, I'm a vegetarian, and I'm thinking about trying a raw food diet. Is it dangerous, or are there just a few foods I should avoid eating raw? Thanks so much. I love your show." Well, a vegetarian thinking about a raw food diet needs to assess several things. First of all, age and the probability of low stomach acid are really important things to think about. Secondly, how good are your teeth? And do you have good food preparation devices, such as a very strong blender and some really sharp knives? Because with raw food, you need to pre-process that food in most cases. So we evolved to be able to handle a raw food diet, but we also evolved to die off in our 40s. As a person enters middle age, the amount of stomach acid that's produced tends to be reduced. Another thing that drastically reduces stomach acid is stress. And the indicator symptom for low stomach acid, there are a couple of them, but the most important one is GERD or reflux. So if your foods repeat, so to speak, or you're tasting that food or maybe a little acid taste in your mouth after meals, then you have to be concerned that things are not moving forward properly. So people with reflux who embark upon a raw food diet need to stimulate their digestive juices. And there's really two ways to do that. You can either add hydrochloric acid in the form of capsules, usually sold as betaine hydrochloride. And with raw foods, you probably want to do 3 or 4 capsules. That's 2,000 milligrams, give or take. There are also things called digestive bitters. And these are strong stimulant agents that trigger the vagus nerve to stimulate, through a spinal reflex, the release of hydrochloric acid. And that will work. And the thing is, you pick the one that works best for you. I would also initially chop or process the raw foods fairly thoroughly. Since you're not going to be cooking them, you can at least pre-chew them, so to speak, with a knife or a blender. And kind of get your feet wet slowly with that. You also have to think about what your protein source is going to be. Bacteria love protein. And a raw food diet, generally the protein is coming from nuts. And some people have problems when they eat large amounts of nuts. They can cause food sensitivity. So it's probably best to make the change gradually and leave the protein source to raw nuts for last, just to be sure that you get it right. The other thing I would recommend is monitoring a methylmalonic acid level, because that will tell you if you're getting into trouble with your B12. Some people need more B12 than others. B12 is primarily found in animal products. Now, you haven't specified whether this is a vegan raw food diet or not, but most of the time when people say raw food, they're talking about a vegan diet. And that's why I'm emphasizing so much the protein and B12 aspects of it. All of this being said, people with strong, good digestive systems who are not under a lot of psychological stress often do beautifully on a raw food diet. And I'm certainly not against them, because you're getting so many healthy bioflavonoids that many of the inflammatory markers in your body will just plummet. Food itself is inflammatory, but some foods, those that cause the release of insulin, are far more inflammatory than others. Another source of inflammation in the diet is saturated fat, which primarily comes from animal products. So, you may be moving into a diet that, on which you will thrive. So, I hope these precautions and my advice to go slowly and make sure that you get adequate protein and monitor that B12 will be helpful. Our next email comes all the way from Madison, Alabama. Judy writes, "Dear Dr. Don, I love your podcast. 3 times over the last 14 years, I've had an episode of fainting when I have been ill with a virus. I don't get sick often, so this constitutes about half of the time over those years. The most recent episode was in February 2016. On this last time, I had been ill for several days before the day I fainted. I had been loading up on fluids the day before, but not during the night. The day I fainted, my fever was 101 degrees. My normal is 97.5. Some of the other times I fainted, I had no fever. Each time, I had only been up 5 minutes or so. I think I am out only a few minutes. When I come to, I'm not aware of much time having passed. I asked my family practice doctor what the cause might be and how to prevent it. She said she could not tell without having examined me at the time, but she thought a visit with a neurologist was in order, so I saw him. He didn't give me any advice except to take Tylenol to reduce the fever when ill. He's sending me for a carotid ultrasound, an EEG, and a brain MRI. I sort of feel this is overkill, but on the other hand, I'm afraid the next time I faint, I will hit my head and really have problems. Could you hazard a guess as to what is causing the fainting episode? The neurologist said this is an emergency and I should call an ambulance and go to the ER the next time it happens. When I land in a sitting position, I have a hard time seeing it as an emergency. I'm 68 years old, 5'8", 140 pounds. Blood pressure runs about 112 over 66. I live alone, although I do have family in the area. I will be listening to see if maybe you can answer this on the podcast. Thanks for your response." Well, Judy, let me start out with saying that reviewing this, I see 2 big possibilities. The first one, which I would give the higher probability, is that this is some form of orthostatic hypotension. This is a condition where a person changes position and their reflexes can't keep up. In this case, when you're lying down for several days because you're sick, you aren't needing a very high blood pressure to send blood to your brain. When you stand up, suddenly you're having to send that blood 5 feet, 8 inches up from your feet to get to your brain, and the blood will tend to pool in the lower legs. Now, you have a reflex tightening of the veins in the lower legs, these so-called capacitance vessels, and that's supposed to squirt the blood back up so that you don't faint. But you don't always have enough juice in those capacitance vessels and in the muscles that contract them to keep from fainting. And there's a complex neurological arc going on, and sometimes the software gets a little bit messed up. So another thing you didn't mention, but I am curious, is if you're on any blood pressure lowering medications or any diuretics, and it might be that you could stop those if you are on them when you get sick. And of course, you didn't mention whether you thought you were dehydrated, but I took from your letter that you didn't think so. And so I'm going to answer as if you had not been dehydrated. Obviously, if you're dehydrated, you faint when you stand up. That's kind of standard. So we're going to dismiss that one. I want to point out that if you get up to go to the bathroom and you pee or poop, the act of that evacuation triggers another reflex arc, which can trigger a faint. And so if it's walking back from the bathroom when you do this, then that could be either micturition or defecation syncope, compounded or brought out by the viral illness affecting your reflexes. So that's something to Google and think about. The other possibility, and this one is scarier, is an arrhythmia. Now, some viruses can, in susceptible individuals, I should say, affect the heart. And that effect, if there's a vulnerability or a kind of bad circuit in the heart, could lead to a rapid heartbeat. And if the heart beats really rapidly, you lose your blood pressure because there isn't enough time to pump the blood. The heart's just kind of quivering. And in that circumstance, you would faint and possibly come to within 30 seconds to a minute and have no real sense that much time had passed. That one is really hard to figure out. And so we can't dismiss the possibility of an arrhythmia. But I want to turn now to the neurologist. Now, the neurologist is doing what a specialist does when given a consultation. I've been doing that now for almost 30 years. And so I'm pretty clear what the playbook is. And the playbook is rule out the usual suspects in your specialty, because you need to find anything that's a neurologic problem that would kill the patient in a year or 6 months. And that what will kill the patient game is a big piece of most specialty referrals. They're almost not even trying to diagnose the problem as much as make sure that it doesn't belong in their bailiwick. And that's understandable. That's how medicine is structured. And I don't want to get up on my soapbox here. But I think it's reasonable at 68 to make sure you don't have a brain tumor or an aneurysm or a seizure disorder or a carotid blockage. But I'll give you odds 99-1 that you probably don't have any of those things as the cause for what you're describing. So go ahead and go through with it because you're 68 and it's my tax dollars at work. But ultimately, I think that's going to be a dry well. I doubt you'll come up with anything. Now, some practical advice, probably the first you've gotten here. First of all, when you get a viral infection, push salty fluids. Talk with your doctor first and clear it, but if you are sick and you're fainting, you probably want to get off your blood pressure medications for the duration, and you need to check with your doctor whether your kidneys and your system will handle the salty fluids. But there's a reason that people drink bouillon and have chicken soup when they're sick, and part of that is to prevent fainting because the sodium pulls fluid into your blood vessels, and the more fluid in those blood vessels, the less important those capacitance vessels in the lower legs are when you stand up. A second trick that helps stimulate those capacitance vessels is what I call the butt dance. So when I have people who faint after they get out of bed, the first thing I have them do is, okay, you're getting dizzy when you stand up. So before you stand up, you're going to sit there for a moment and you're going to clench your butt muscles, which, by the way, if you do it right now, sitting in your chair, which probably 99% of my audience is sitting in their chair, big shout out to those of you who are standing or exercising. Go you. But anyway, butt clench raises your body about a half an inch to an inch, depending on the anatomy, out of your chair. So do about 10 solid butt clenches along with fist clenches. So clench and relax and clench and relax and do that 10 times before you get up. And if you are heading into the bathroom with your viral infections, which I'm thinking is quite likely, why would you get up out of bed otherwise? Then while you're sitting on the pot, do more butt clenches. And do them before you stand up and start to walk back to your bedroom. Another thing I would suggest, and you mentioned bonking your head when you fall, but I'm worried about breaking a hip or becoming incapacitated or maybe not waking up from that because, and that's why I really want you to get that neurologic workup. Consider asking a family member to stay with you or to call every couple of hours when you are sick, or consider possibly one of those medical alert devices that triggers when you stop moving. These are relatively new technology, but I know they exist, and that might be something that you just put on only when you have a viral illness. Having a family member or friend stay with you when you're sick would be the best solution. And since you have family nearby, that might even be a possibility. So think about those things. And certainly you could ask neighbors or other people to check on you periodically. You don't want to be down, unable to get to a phone. So if you have a cell phone, that needs to be glued to your body when you're sick. If you did fall and break something and couldn't get to a phone to summon help, the act of just lying there is very, very bad for you and could lead to premature end to what sounds like a healthy and vigorous life. So we don't want to go there. I hope this has been helpful. And I just want to let you know that most of us, when we have a viral illness and stand up and go to the bathroom, get a little woozy if we have low blood pressure. And the butt clench and the fist clench stuff comes from the fact that I'm a fainter. And I've actually had a faint during training when I was taking out an appendix. I'm very proud of the fact that the patient and her appendix went into the appropriate places. I did a backflip and landed on my head, and fortunately for me, there was an attending physician in the room to take care of the patient. But after that, I was very careful not to push myself, and that's something you need to do as well. Our next email comes from Lithuania. Monica writes, I haven't been diagnosed with anything yet, although I've been prescribed aripiprazole, 15 milligrams. I'm just wondering what happens if I take aripiprazole and I don't need it. My psychiatrist thinks I'm having psychosis, but I strongly disagree. Well, Monica, let's start out with one bit of information. This drug in the United States is called Abilify, and it's part of a class of agents called atypical antipsychotics. And so that's appropriate if your psychiatrist thinks you're having psychosis. And one of the symptoms of psychosis can be a lack of insight. So that puts the patient in a real vulnerable position because people will tend to discount their opinion because they don't think their opinion's worth anything because they have psychosis. We run into this problem in our society all the time, and I think there's a great deal of, how shall I put this? It's very difficult to figure out whether the diagnosis is appropriate and the doctor's right and the patient's wrong, or the diagnosis is inappropriate and there's something else going on with the patient. So with psychosis, one of the most common symptoms people have is hearing things. And so if you are actually hearing things that other people don't hear, I think you have to take that very seriously. Try the agent and see whether that phenomenon disappears. And I'm afraid, my dear, if it does, then you have to accept the doctor's diagnosis. Abilify is often used to treat bipolar disorder at low doses, such as the one that you've been recommended. And bipolar disorder is a different animal entirely, but the agent works to stabilize dopamine levels, which is implicated in both of these mental health issues. Now, in terms of what could happen if you take it and you don't need it, nothing will happen. If you don't need it, nothing will get fixed, nothing will change, and that would be a good indication that you don't actually need it. On the other hand, if you notice an improvement in the way your life is working or in your ability to get along with others, and particularly in the way other people react to you, then it may be that your doctor has a point. Side effects of this are the usual suspects, nausea, headache, GI upset, things like that. But these drugs do carry a risk of problems with heat. So, for example, you're more likely to get heat stroke, and there's a very rare adverse reaction of rapid heartbeat and heat stroke in very, very high body temperature that can be life-threatening. And I want to emphasize that's very rare, but when we see it in two circumstances, and one is in overdose, another is in mixing with other agents. And I should have said three circumstances, because the third is if you exercise when it's really hot, you can get heat stroke or even trigger this neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So the dose that you're taking is fairly low. And I think as long as you use precautions and don't exercise in the heat, you should be fine. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. We have new projects in the works, and I have good news. It looks like we'll probably be back on the air as of the first Saturday in July. Watch the website for more news about that. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.